Well, welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. And of course, Lionel Fanthorpe started as a journalist years ago in the United Kingdom and then was a headmaster at a high school in Cardiff. Lionel is a popular television and radio presenter in his own right. He is an ordained Anglican priest. He's qualified as a weight training instructor. He's a motorcyclist, and he has written well over 250 books in his career. You just never stop there, Lionel.
Well, I try not to, George. I try not to.
And the latest, of course,
is called... I love all the things that I do, and that keeps me going.
In your latest book, Big Book of Mysteries.
Yeah, that's one. It's a compilation of many of the mysteries which Patricia and I have investigated over, it doesn't seem possible, but it's over 50 years ago that we started looking into the unsolved mysteries and the paranormal and strange phenomena. And so the Big Book of Mysteries has got, what do we say, we've picked the plums off the tree and put them all into one collection.
You know, in talking to you sometimes, there's a television program out here now called American Horror Story. And, you know, it's growing in popularity, but they deal with very bizarre, different haunting stories and scary mysteries. And you do that too, don't you?
Yeah, we certainly do. And one of the things that I've never been able to find an answer to is that famous Barbados coffin mystery going right back to the early 19th century when Lord Combermere was the governor of Barbados. He'd been one of the Duke of Wellington's assistants fighting in Spain against Napoleon, and as a reward, he was given the governorship. Well, the great mystery was that in a tomb belonging to the Chase Elliott family, every time a member of that family passed over, and you had to walk down a flight of steps to get to the tomb itself, the top of which was level with the cemetery surface at Christchurch near St. Oysten's, and the coffins had moved. Now, these are not little wooden coffins. These, because they were built for use in the tropics, were huge lead sarcophagi, and they weighed, oh, at least a ton each. So to move one of those would have been like trying to pick up and move a car. Would have needed at least 8 or 10 men to do it. The place was sealed on Combermere's orders. He put sand, coral stone sand, on the floor. And the next time it was opened, just a few weeks later, the coffins were all over the place. One of them was 3/4 of the way up the staircase, as though the guy inside it was trying to get out. And the rest were everywhere. And Combermere said, that's it. And so he spoke to the Reverend Audison, who was the vicar there, and said, with your agreement, we'll take them all out. We'll bury them in separate graves in the churchyard 6 feet down. And that was what was done. And when we went over there to make a documentary for the BBC, the tomb was completely empty. A strange place. Nobody ever knows what moved those coffins.
What do you think?
Well, I can't help wondering whether there's some strange electromagnetic force which acts on non-ferrous metals. As you and I know, and our listeners know, normal magnetism needs to have iron or steel. But I suppose there was some other curious force operating just in that one area there in Barbados, which affected lead, because there was one wooden coffin in there, and that one never moved. It's got something to do. If there is a rational scientific explanation, it's got to have something to do with the lead. But still unsolved after nearly 250 years.
Did you see that story, Lionel, that they think they have, through DNA, found Jack the Ripper? And they think he was a bartender out there.
Yes. Now, the theories about, in fact, we sometimes refer to it, and I'm sure you do in the USA as well, as the science of ripperology, and the number of people who've studied the old police reports and the early newspapers that came out contemporary with the discoveries of the bodies, the theories had pinpointed at least half a dozen suspects, but the brilliant advances in the use of DNA and the ability to analyze DNA, even from a remote point in the past, does certainly point in a whole new direction for us. And as science progresses and we know even more about the constitution of DNA and what it might do, how much we can discover from it and how accurately it can point in a given direction, I think that's as good a theory as any that have yet come forward.
We're with Lionel Fanthorpe. His latest book, Big Book of Mysteries. I had just gotten done talking to two individuals about Sasquatch, about Bigfoot, and they are planning to go out into the wilderness and shoot one. I'm opposed to that, of course, but that's what they think, that's what they have to do, and they think that Bigfoot is, you know, dangerous in some cases. What do you think? Because I noticed that Yeti and Sasquatch, they're in your new book, The Big Book of Mysteries.
Yes, yeah, they certainly are. And it seems that from a whole series of reports, because not only do we have Yeti on the mountain peaks there in the Himalayas and the over there in the area of Nepal, but the Sasquatch in the USA and Canada, and there has also been, or there have also been, reports of something very similar, of which was called the Siberian Giant, so coming over from the Russian area.
Hmm.
It does seem that in remote areas, it's possible that there are the traces, the last few descendants of a race of giant, or whether they are semi-human or whether they are like us but just bigger than us. Like you, I would be opposed to shooting one unless it was done with a tranquilizer. I think we should treat them as abnormally large human beings rather than as monsters that want to be shot, because there have been occasions when in some of the Tibetan legends they had been quite benign. And there's one of the Tibetan stories of this girl who was had gone out to look for a child who'd run away from home and had got lost. And the mother went to find him, and both she and the child were brought back to the village alive. And when they recovered, they went looking, and there was a trail of giant footprints, as if one of these enormous Yeti had seen and felt sorry for the lost child and the brave young woman who was looking for her child, and had tucked one under each arm and taken them back home as close as he dared go to a human village. Now, that certainly doesn't make them sound like monsters.
No, it does not. They've got some intelligence there.
Yeah, there's intelligence there and some sort of positive emotion, some kind of sympathy and empathy. So I think that if you've got enough honest witnesses, and this is what I base my own scientific research on, but if you can trace accounts from enough honest and reputable witnesses to a particular phenomenon, whether it's the Yeti, the Sasquatch, or the Siberian Giant, that even if only 1% of the reports are accurate as well as being truthful and honest, then there is something there. And the number of reports is such that I would be prepared to bet on the existence of the Sasquatch and of the Yeti. And I think that possibly, see, if we go back to Old Testament times and you find that fascinating text, there were giants on the earth in those days, it looks as if among the early Hebrew legends that there are accounts of beings, not just like Goliath, who was just an extra large human being, but really big fellas going up to, say, 9-10 feet. and that they may have shared an intelligence level that wasn't far from ours. Different, but nevertheless intelligence and awareness. So I think that sooner or later, somebody is going to either find one or get an indisputable photograph of one. But I think the most important point that you made was that we should do everything we can to discourage anyone from shooting one.
Right, exactly. I mean, these things could be some of the wonders of the world. And
they certainly could. And who knows that if we could come across them, make contact with them, communicate with them, there might be certain advances that they have made, maybe just in order to survive, that could be of enormous value to our medical science and our biological science. If they have discovered ways, or if they have within their genes and their DNA means of overcoming extreme cold or the other hazards that are up there, who's to say how much we could benefit from learning from them, if only we could cooperate with them instead of regarding them as dangerous beasts.
We're with Lionel Fenthorpe, the big book of mysteries, vampires. You look at them. What did you uncover?
Yes, we certainly do. Now, I would like to make the point that in all the Transylvanian stories, the famous things that Bram Stoker wrote about Count Dracula, who was really a ruler named Vlad Dracul, or Vlad the Impaler, a singularly unpleasant historical character. In addition to what we might call traditional vampire theory and storytelling and myths and legends, there are characters whom I would describe as psychic vampires. Now, I think we will all have had the experience of being perhaps at a party or at a family gathering or in a board meeting. I can remember this happening when I was headmastering at the big high school. And we had about 100 colleagues on the staff, and you could be having a really excellent staff meeting, a lot of positive ideas coming forward for improvements you could make to help the students, and then another member of staff who had not been there at the start of the meeting comes into the room, and you could almost sense the atmosphere changing. The presence of that person seemed to draw the energy and the goodwill and the good feelings. It was as if, to use the allegory, the room went dark at that point. Now, I refer to such people as psychic vampires. There seems to be something in certain personalities that can come in, and without saying a word, just by its presence.
Drain a room.
The meeting. Have you come across
that? Oh, my gosh. All the time, Lionel. All the time. And most of them phone. Most of them don't know that they're doing this.
No, they don't. And this is what's strange. It is almost as though there was something within them. If we think about psychic energy, if we go to the opposite end of the scale, there are people, and usually, in my experience, these are much loved members of the family or the friendship group, and you can be sitting working at your desk and one of them will come in and say hi, and you suddenly feel that the light has got brighter, the air has got purer and more breathable, and where your energy was sagging over a rather boring and monotonous list of things that you had to do, you suddenly think, hey, this isn't so bad, I can get through this by 10:30. And these people are the very opposite of the psychic vampires. They're the psychic generators. They come in and they're radiating a loving energy which makes you feel that that you're 10 years younger and that you can get the job done in half the time. And I think if we do a scale of all the people we know with what I call the psychic generators at one end and the psychic vampires at the other, we've got this range. Most of us are somewhere in the middle, where we do our best as good guys to try and help other people, but we don't have quite the impact that these amazingly energetic and positive people have when they come and they can sort of lighten the whole scene. And whether it's possible to develop a sort of psychic generating power or whether it's just born in us, I don't know. But the idea of wanting to bring happiness to the people around you, coming in with an earnest desire to help and to oblige and to, because you simply like to see a smile on the faces of your colleagues and your family and your friends. And maybe it's something that could be developed. Be interesting to hear what some of our listeners think about psychic vampires or psychic generators in their circle. Because I think what you and I have experienced, George, are pretty well global, worldwide.
And what about those people who know what they're doing? They feed off other people. They need it, like real vampires.
Yes, they do. Now, when you mentioned that, I've remembered the wonderful books that C.S. Lewis wrote, in which he talks about, in his particular one, which was written from the, very jokingly, from the standpoint of the demon called Screwtape, the thing called the Screwtape Letters, came out about 50 years ago. And in it, the demons, according to Lewis, feed on human misery, human despair, human depression, that it is their energy source. And there are people, and again, you and I will have come across some of these, who genuinely seem to derive pleasure and energy, almost to enjoy feeding on the rest of us. They're rather like the idea of a teacher of the wrong kind at a school for very young children, going out in the playground and deliberately trying to stop games that they're enjoying on the grounds that they're not safe or that they're making too much noise or that they're disturbing other kids. And these people seem to relish putting an end to other people's pleasure. And I suspect, psychologically, this could be because they themselves, these people that we might call psychic vampires, have little or no ability to enjoy life. It's the people who enjoy their own lives who become the psychic generators. And it's the people who have got no enjoyment, no satisfaction, who are pessimistic and introspective all the time. They're the ones who seem to derive pleasure from stopping the pleasure of other people. If we look at it from the entirely opposite point of view, thing I shall never forget, long time ago, when I passed my driving test for a motorbike first and then for a car.
What were you in? A Model T? You were in a Model T then, weren't you?
Yeah, just about.
Kidding.
I think I was an inspiration to Henry Ford. He said, that boy needs a car. I'll build a Model T for him.
Hold on. We'll pick up the story, Lionel, when we come right back. Our final segment with the greatest storyteller ever born, Lionel Fanthorpe, whose website linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. We're talking about his latest work, The Big Book of Mysteries. We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Lionel Fanthorpe with us. His work, A Big Book of Mysteries, available at Amazon.com, by the way. It is also available, is it not? Is it on the Kindle version, too, or just the book version, Lionel?
Yeah, no, it's on Kindle along with the other books I've got on Amazon, which I just mentioned, if I may. There's my science fantasy trilogy, which is The Black Lion, The Golden Tiger, and Zutal of the Priest. They're all up there on Amazon. And an historical romance, historical adventure romance set in the days of the Roman Empire called Garin of the Veneti. And Amazon has them all in Kindle.
I can't wait for Christmas Eve, because we get to play 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, your rendition for us.
You know, I am so honored by that. I feel so tremendously rewarded that, you know, a really important show like yours and all our listeners on Coast to Coast, who I think of as friends I haven't met yet.
Have you ever heard it, the finished version with the music mixed with it and everything else?
I haven't heard the music.
We've got to get you a copy of that.
Oh, that's great.
I'll make sure that Tom sends you a copy.
Thank you very much indeed. I really look forward to that. That would be a great Christmas present, and thank you. And that little story we were starting just before the break, I was going back to when I was 17, and as I'm 80 next birthday, that was a while back. And I just passed my driving test, and I thought, I am the happiest man who ever lived. I have got my own little car, as you were laughing about the Ford T model. I got my own little car, I'm on the road, I'm independent, and I didn't think it was possible to be happier. Well, then, 5 or 6 years later, when Patricia and I were married, and that was in 1957, first thing I wanted to do for her was to teach her to drive. When she passed her test, which she did first time, when I taught her and she passed her test, the look on her face, you know, darling, I passed. And I just felt so incredibly happy. Now, I felt 1,000 times happier than when I had passed my test. And this is what you and I were talking about with the psychic generators as opposed to the psychic vampires.
That's right.
That if you do your best to be a psychic generator and to give pleasure to people you love, or to give pleasure to anyone that you can, then I think you're doing the right thing and you're making the whole darned world a better place. And one of the other things I was asked recently to do some voiceovers for my friend Brennan Callan and his friend John Ocampo at a very advanced secret sort of scientific experiment. I've got to keep it under wraps for the moment, but it's going to be a tremendous thing that they've discovered between them. And I've got the voiceover script has just arrived, and I'm looking forward so much to recording it for them. It was when you mentioned my recording of the Christmas theme. At the other extreme, I do voiceovers for science.
Yeah, and you do them well, too. So, tell me about the Sphinx and the pyramids.
Wow. Well, now there we've got one of the most enormous mysteries of all time, because when contemporary Egyptologists go out there and excavate, and when the archaeologists are doing their work on the Sphinx and the pyramids, we discover more and more about their real history. And then, when of course we go across to look at the ancient Mayan pyramids as well, and their strange old temple buildings, the huge question mark that comes up is, did someone with very advanced technology not only show the Mayans how to build, did they also show the Egyptians? And the great question mark points down and says, was Atlantis really there? So was there at one time a group of tremendously advanced people with a technology that's at least the equal of ours today in the 21st century? And were they doing things to help the early developing races like the Mayans and the Egyptians, opposite sides of the world? And what could we learn from the pyramids? What can we learn from the old Mayan temples? See, when you think of the weight of some of those stones, and let's take in Easter Island as well.
Oh my God, tons and tons of weight.
Yeah, enormous weight. And they got no machinery to move it. And it makes you wonder, did telekinesis exist? Were there people whose minds were so powerful that by concentrating they could move those great stones? I mean, there's even a legend that the great stones of Stonehenge were raised by telekinesis rather than by simple mechanical means, by, you know, digging holes and dropping them into the holes. And it does just make you wonder whether there were powers there. You know, when we get very interesting episodes today of telepathy, where there are, especially in some of the showbiz telepathy shows, where you've got the idea of being able to transmit a message straight from mind to mind. Is that a vestigial trace among those gifted people who can really do it? Is that a vestigial trace of something from the remote past? Let's just imagine 10,000 years ago, your ancestor and one of mine were out hunting together to bring essential food back to the women and children in the village. And we saw an animal going past. Now, we've only got spears, or maybe bows and arrows if we're lucky. But unless we can surprise this animal, the women and children we love back home in the village are going to go hungry. What if we could think to each other silently, and your ancestor tells my ancestor, go round to the left of him, and I'll go the other side. And the animal doesn't hear us make a noise or speak, and we capture him, and we bring him back to the village, and we feed the women and children. Now, that was something which was essential to survival 10,000 years ago, to be able to signal without disturbing the prey. What if there are some of us who are still carrying that in our DNA, and that when we see a pair of telepaths working together on stage or on television or on radio, that what they're carrying with them is something that their hunting ancestors found to be essential to survival? Just a thought.
A great thought. Let's take a few calls here, Lionel, then we'll check in on a couple more stories. Daryl in Ohio, you're on with us. Daryl, go ahead.
Hey, how you guys doing this morning?
Good, Daryl. Thank you.
We're fine.
All right. Good, good. I want to talk a little bit about the psychic vampires.
Sure.
That you were talking about. See if maybe I've had an issue. I've never been able to talk about it, but luckily, I was listening to the show tonight, Call It Tape.
Okay.
I have this issue of being around people and their negative emotions affecting me. Like, when I was training for this truck driver job, I had a trainer. He was arguing with his girlfriend. A lot of anger, a lot of emotion. I started feeling sick. And all of a sudden, this calmness went around him, where he was no longer angry, but I was. He said one thing to me, I flipped out, I walked out the truck and took a walk around to calm down. And I've been dealing with this for a long time. I've never really been able to put a finger on what it could be.
Well, I'd like to take up what you're saying there, which is extremely interesting. And what I'm wondering is whether there are a number of people, maybe all of us to a greater or lesser extent, who are sensitive, more sensitive than some others perhaps, to mood and emotion. If we call it empathy, then if you look at a group of young children, say in a nursery or a kindergarten, if one of them starts to cry or one of them starts to laugh or one of them feels happy and dances and shouts, then at that stage of our lives, we, as very young children, are more likely to empathize with the character who's showing either the happy or the unhappy or the vibrant emotion or the anger. And you'll find that the majority of the group are picking it up. Now, as we grow older and become adults, we've still retained a little of that ability, that sensitivity to other people's moods. Let's just take the analogy of sight and hearing. There are some people with very acute hearing, other people with very acute clear vision, whereas a lot of the rest of us need glasses or hearing aids. Now, if we think of emotional input as being something like sight and hearing, then when somebody, like the example you gave us, which was a very interesting one, somebody comes in with a bad mood of anger, and that can be transferred to a being, another human being, who is sensitive in the sense of some of us have good hearing, some of us have good eyesight, some of us have very acute psychic emotional awareness, and we will pick up moods faster than others. Whereas if you think of the typical, maybe very practiced salesman who goes in with a product that the customer is not likely to buy, but against all the negative attitude of the customer, the salesman is able to ignore that. So he's at the other end of the scale. He doesn't pick up the customer's reluctance. He goes on pushing the product which he believes in and which he's selling, and he's successful. So that at one end, you've got those of us who are almost impervious to the other atmosphere. There are some politicians who can come into a room full of rival politicians and just go straight over the top of them with the policies that they are talking about. And on the other occasions, I said, you've got the person who is so easily influenced. Now, I think that we're all on this scale from sort of A to infinity, and that when someone like yourself, who has a high degree of sensitivity to other people's emotions, picks up the anger, it's as if the anger had been transferred, almost like an electric current. And that makes a great deal of sense to me, to think of it as being the perception of emotion in others and the transference of it to the person who's receiving. Does that make sense to you?
It sure does to all of us, I'll tell you that. A couple more minutes to go here, Lionel. I wanted to ask you before we take final calls about the Bermuda Triangle. What do you think is causing these very strange occurrences there?
Well, I think it is one of the greatest anomalous phenomena of all time. That, again, we go back and we pick up the ideas, the reports of the people who have experienced it and their ideas to explain it. It is possible. I think the best theory I have ever come across, and I'd love to win the national lottery so that I could hire a submarine and some divers and go and have a look. But I wonder if somewhere under the central waters of the Bermuda Triangle there is a device, or there is the remains of an ancient civilization, back to the Atlantis ideas, where let's imagine that there was a piece of superior technology which was used in that area for some perfectly good and positive purpose. But just as what happens when a nuclear power station is flooded or hit by an earthquake, a thing that was originally designed for the best possible motives to do something, maybe to help the fishermen in that area, and it's gone wrong, an earthquake has hit it, and the power that should have been directed in a good direction has now become an attraction of the wrong kind, which is bringing down planes and sinking ships.
It's very bizarre.
It is indeed. Yeah, weird.
Let's take a call from KC in Washington. KC, go ahead.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that I believe that you are the opposite of the psychic vampire. What did you call that?
He's a positive person, no doubt.
The hot psychic, yeah.
Yeah.
Because I've just, you know, been having a real rough time and just been sick, and you've just put a smile on my face, and I do understand the psychic vampirism, because when I was younger, I knew a couple of these guys that would, for some reason, I didn't know what was happening at the time, but they took my all my insecurities and fears and they would ask me all these questions about myself. And then as the relationship continued on, they would make me feel really down about myself, and I'd almost be really embarrassed at times. And I felt like they would kind of relish in that and make themselves feel better and positive. And it was weird because I'd come back for more and more and more, you know, and I never understood what that was until later. And they basically would do it on purpose to make themselves feel better. And but you're great. You're incredible. I love your voice, your accent, and you've made my night. Thank you very much.
Casey, you're much kinder than I deserve. And I can say you've made my night if I have been of help to one brother or sister anywhere in God's universe. That makes my day. As a priest, I care enormously about people. And if I can make someone happy, if I can relieve any pain or anxiety to the best of my ability, then that's my purpose in life. And you made me feel really good. Thank you so much for calling in.
You have been, over the years for us, Lionel, just a wonderful friend and just a great guest.
Oh, thank you, George, very much indeed.
And let's keep in touch. Let's try to get together before Christmas and chat again, okay?
Of course we can. Whenever you want me, you know you've got an automatic yes. I love working with you and Tom, and I love being there with our listeners.
Give Patricia a hug for us, would you?
I will do. She'll love it.
Lionel Fanthorpe. I call him the greatest storyteller ever born, and you can tell. Make sure you go to our website, check out his... And in his latest book, The Big Book of Mysteries, it's one of those great stories because he's got much more in there than what we talked about. And make sure you're part of our program tomorrow and then Thursday and Friday and Saturday. It just doesn't stop. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, George Knapp, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.